Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. We have good stuff ahead for the next hour. We have another fascinating installment in our series of interviews with our Iowa neighbors from the continent of Africa. Today we go to Egypt, so you know that's going to be a story. It's Friday, so we start with a roundup of local news from the past week. Here is Dennis Hart with the local news.
We begin with the front page of Tuesday's Ames Tribune, and the big story there was the resignation of Iowa State Senate Republican Majority Leader Bill Dix, who quit after a video of him kissing a woman in a Des Moines bar was published in an online blog. Dix's resignation was effective at 2 o'clock Monday afternoon. The video that led to his resignation showed Dix, who is from Shell Rock, sitting at a bar talking to and kissing a woman. That video appeared on the blog Iowa Starting Line. The blog suggested the woman was a lobbyist for various municipal interests. Dix is married with three teenage children. He served 5 2-year terms in the Iowa House and later won a seat in the Iowa Senate in 2010. His Senate district covers a wide part of eastern Story County. His resignation came several months after the state Senate paid a $1.75 million settlement to a former Senate Republican staffer who alleged she was fired after filing a complaint of a toxic work environment caused by sexual harassment in 2013. Rick Sanders, the Republican chairman of the Story County Board of Supervisors, said he was shocked by the video and Dix's resignation. Sanders said, in his words, "I don't get really, really stunned all that often. I'm stunned by this." Both Sanders and Dix spoke at the Story County Republican Convention over the weekend. Brett Barker, the mayor of Nevada and chairman of the Story County GOP, said Dix's behavior showed, in Barker's words, a severe lack of judgment. As of Monday, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds had 5 days to call for a special election to fill the vacancy. The election would be scheduled at least 18 days after her announcement. The major parties will hold nominating conventions to select their candidates for the special election. Also in Tuesday's Tribune, the general manager of the Ames Fitness Center sent an email last week urging investors to oppose the city and other entities' plans to build the Healthy Life Center. In that email, Tom Durkin wrote, in his words, "We need to get this voted down." He sent that email after meeting with the heads of Mary Greeley Hospital and Heartland Senior Services, who are members of the Healthy Life Center's steering committee. Durkin reportedly told them he's concerned with a government-owned facility that would be in competition with the private sector, and also the operating loss the proposed facility will have. The Healthy Life Center is still in the conceptual stage, and it's estimated it will cost nearly $49 million to build and equip. Up to four organizations, Heartland, Mary Greeley, the City of Ames, and Story County, could contribute millions to the project. Under current plans, a private fundraising effort has to raise about $18 million of that $49 million. Durkin told the Tribune he's opposed to the center's projected operating costs and the potential that they could raise property taxes. A consultant's report estimated the facility would operate at a nearly $475,000 deficit. Durkin said that is an unfair burden to taxpayers and questions whether the city even needs a Healthy Life Center. Ames City Manager Steve Shanker said property taxes would indeed increase to pay for the bond the city would use to pay for its share of the project. Ames voters would have to approve the bond, which is set to run $15 million. Tuesday's Tribune also reported that three people were arrested after police said they cut off parts of a Hunziker youth sports complex bleacher to sell as scrap. Those arrested were identified as 40-year-old Michael Zanoni, 37-year-old Samuel Joseph, and 27-year-old Jennifer Duncan. They were charged with third-degree theft. Ames Police Commander Jeff Huff said police received a call about suspicious activity early Saturday afternoon. Authorities stopped the suspects and reportedly found several pieces of metal that appeared to be cut from a bleacher and a saw capable of cutting metal in the suspect's vehicle. The suspects allegedly told authorities they found the metal already cut off. The medal was valued between $500 and $1,000. Also in Tuesday's Tribune, a feature story about how 20 Iowa State University students are working with five business owners in Jewell to ensure the town's Main Street community remains vital. The students are in an entrepreneurship and human sciences class, and they're offering strategies to help small businesses succeed. The project kicked off at the beginning of the month when the students toured Jewell's Main Street district and met with business owners and local leaders. Those students will develop a plan and present it sometime next month. Jewell Mayor Mick Walker told the Tribune that over the past decades, downtown has changed dramatically and that his community has become a bedroom town. But he said the community has not done too badly and that, in his words, we're still on the map. That's more than some little towns can say. Tuesday's Trib also reported that the Raising Readers in Story County program is expanding its Summer Reading Buddies program to Huxley. Raising Readers focuses on maintaining or improving literacy skills for struggling readers. The program will be seeking volunteers. In Wednesday's Tribune, word that the Story County Board of Supervisors approved the county's 2019 fiscal year budget on Tuesday. That budget shows the county expects to bring in just more than $43 million and spend a bit less than that. The budget sets the county's urban tax rate at $5.06 per $1,000 of taxable value and the rural rate at $8.24 per thousand. The budget includes 2% cost of living increases for county employees, both union and non-union. The supervisors also approved a 3% salary hike for themselves and other Story County elected officials. The supervisors, auditor, recorder, and treasurer will earn an annual salary of just over $80,000 during the next fiscal year. The sheriff will make $133,000 and the county attorney will make $139,000. The approval marks the sixth balanced budget in a row for Story County. The supervisors also awarded bids for several county projects, including a bid for $216,000 to resurface West 190th Street near the Prairie Moon Winery, and another bid for $316,000 for the 120th Street Bridge Replacement Project. Also Wednesday in the Tribune, a story about the 2017 Condition of Education Report produced by the Iowa Department of Education. That report contained information about the state's kindergarten through 12th grade education system. In Ames, the report showed that the school district employed 356 staff members over the 2016-2017 school year, compared to 342 the year before. 16 were administrators, 261 were general instruction teachers, 54 were special education instructors, and 25 were support staff such as counselors, nurses, and teacher librarians. The district employed 8 principals at an average salary of $101,000 and 4 assistant principals at a salary of $88,000. Superintendent Tim Taylor was the highest paid Ames staff member with a salary of $168,000. The average salary for general education teachers in Ames was $59,000. 75% of Ames general instruction teachers were female, with about 2% of them being minorities. Also Wednesday, the Tribune reported that residents in the Gilbert School District will have a chance to learn more about the district's bond issue to raise money for school improvements during a forum scheduled for next Tuesday. That forum will take place at 7 p.m. in the Gilbert High School Auditorium. Gilbert School District voters will go to the polls April 3rd to consider a $14 million bond issue that would help renovate all the district schools, along with multiple athletic and fine art facilities. That measure needs 60% approval to pass. Wednesday's Tribune also reported that police have arrested 2 Ames residents for falsely reporting a drive-by shooting last December. 36-year-old Tracy Marie Flores and 35-year-old Rafael Angel Flores were charged with falsely reporting an indictable offense to a public entity. The false incident was reported December 12th when officers responded to a shots fired call in the 500 block of Stanton Avenue and found Tracy Flores suffering from a gunshot wound to a leg. Witnesses originally claimed they had seen a sedan driving northbound and heard gunshots, but it turns out, police now say, Tracy Flores was wounded as the result of an accidental shooting. One more note from Wednesday's Tribune, word that the first Wingstop franchise owned by former Iowa State quarterback Seneca Wallace is set to open next Wednesday. The chicken wing restaurant at 703 South Duff Avenue has been in the works since at least last fall. Thursday's Tribune reported on the 10th annual County Day at the Capitol, which took place Wednesday in Des Moines. Story County Board of Supervisors Chairman Rick Sanders was there talking about the potential loss of hundreds of thousands of dollars of so-called backfill money in the county. That is replacement money the state has been providing cities and counties to make up for property tax money lost when the legislature cut property taxes for commercial and industrial properties 5 years ago. Now state lawmakers are talking about phasing out those backfill payments. Sanders said if the county loses backfill money, the supervisors could decide not to pursue projects like bridge replacements. They could cut services, or they could even consider staff reductions. Also Thursday, the Trib reported that the Ames Soccer Club will have to spend $7,000 to replace equipment damaged by individuals who cut several pieces of metal from the bleachers and soccer goals at the Hunziker Youth Sports Complex. 16 goals at the complex were either stolen or destroyed, along with 2 15-foot benches. Also in Thursday's Tribune, word that a Story County District Court judge has delayed the trial for a Nevada man accused of killing his infant daughter. 30-year-old Calvin Curtis White is charged with first-degree murder and child endangerment causing death. He faces life in prison without parole if he's found guilty. His trial had been scheduled to begin next month, but a judge delayed it until August. White was arrested last month after he was released from a hospital where he had been treated for injuries he suffered when he was struck by a train that week in Nevada. Hours before he was struck, authorities received a call from the child's mother saying the child was not breathing. The girl died shortly after police arrived. Court documents show White admitted to killing the child to prevent hearing her cry. One more note from Thursday's Tribune, Union Pacific train representatives invited the Trib to board an engine on Wednesday and watch the process conductors and engineers go through when their trains cross through Ames. It's part of a national effort to emphasize crossing safety. The engine traveled on Ames tracks around 15 miles an hour, but usually go through secluded parts of town around 40 miles an hour. As the engine was preparing to start moving west through downtown, the conductor spotted a pedestrian who was running across the tracks as the crossing lights and bells went off. An Ames police officer who was along for the ride called it in to his radio, and a few minutes later a police car was positioned near the tracks, watching for runners and drivers who were trying to beat the train. Later during the ride, a driver crossed over the tracks just as the crossing arms were falling into place. All of this is dangerous and potentially fatal behavior, which is why Union Pacific took the Tribune along for a ride. You can read all about it in Thursday's paper. In this week's Nevada Journal, a report on Monday's city council meeting where the council approved the fiscal year 2018-2019 budget and the capital improvement plan. Also at the council meeting, the council voted to go ahead with the design phase for a recreation center project. Council members also heard that city engineers should be ready in May to seek bids for the Airport Road Lincoln Highway Improvement Project, which will include putting in more lanes for vehicles that are turning into Airport Road. Also in the journal, word that the city of Nevada will hold a public forum on substance abuse next Thursday. It will take place starting at 6 p.m. at Gates Hall and involve healthcare professionals, law enforcement personnel, and community service organizations. Also in the journal, word that more than 260 Nevada FFA members, parents, and guests took part in the annual FFA banquet at Gates Hall recently, and word that the Nevada JC's group is making plans for its 18th annual bike ride that will take place on Saturday, May 5th. That ride offers 14, 32, or 43-mile loops on paved county highways. And there's a feature story on Nevada Mayor Brett Barker, who was elected last November and is, at the age of 34, the youngest mayor in Story County. In this week's Boone News Republican, a long story about the recent contentious meeting between the Boone County Board of Supervisors and the County Historical Society. The supervisors wanted to talk about a potential meeting between the Historical Society and the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower Birthplace Museum Foundation. The Eisenhower Museum in Boone has been temporarily closed, and there seems to be no consensus about what should happen next. Historical Society Board President Janet Tate told the supervisors that the foundation and the community have not contributed enough money over the past few years to even rebuild the porch of the Eisenhower home. Supervisor Steve Duffy said those who might want to contribute to the building want to make sure their money is spent only on the Eisenhower birthplace. Tate said the society owns the birthplace and, in her words, don't have to sell it to anyone at any price. It's a complex issue, one that those involved seemingly cannot reach agreement on, and you can read all about it in this week's Boone News Republican. Also in the News Republican, word that the Boone County Conservation Board voted to restrict the use of alcohol on the High Trestle Trail near Madrid during its meeting this week. The new regulation only restricts the consumption of alcohol on the trail or the bridge, not the possession or transport of alcohol. Officials said the regulation will make the trail and bridge safer and more family-friendly. The Conservation Board also approved leaving the bridge's lights on until midnight from April 1st through October 31st. The lights had been turned off around 10:30 p.m. The News Republican also reported that a nonpartisan group will offer free rides to the March for Our Lives event that will be held at the Des Moines Capitol on Saturday, March 24th. Unity in the Community will offer the rides to the march, which is designed in part to demand that gun violence is brought to an end in schools and communities. There was more in the News Republican, including word that Boone County Freedom Flight 2017 veterans, guardians, and Freedom Flight members gathered in the Sacred Heart School gym last Sunday for a reunion. 141 people had gone to Washington, D.C. last October. During Sunday's reunion, the veterans were presented with handmade honor quilts, and Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate gave pins and cards to each veteran. And there was word that Fairway Stores employees had donated $830 to the Boone County Sheriff's Office. That money will be used in the Sheriff's Canine Unit for such things as training for the dogs and outfitting a patrol car to hold a canine. The News Republican also reported that there was a big turnout at the Boone Area Chamber of Commerce's annual meeting recently. At that meeting, numerous awards were presented to various individuals in the community. And there was word that Laura Novak of Boone is seeking the Republican nomination for Boone County Treasurer in the June 5th primary. Novak now works in the treasurer's office. In this week's Story City Herald, the Roland Story School District will hold its first mental health event for students, parents, and the public next Thursday. It will take place starting at 6 p.m. at the high school auditorium. Sessions will be offered on the topics of depression, cyberbullying, anxiety, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, eating disorders, and more. Also in the Herald, word that the Story City Friends Endowment is accepting funding applications from local nonprofit organizations. Approximately $2,200 will be awarded this year to qualified nonprofits that make an impact in Story City. And that is your weekly look at news from the pages of the Ames Tribune and other nearby newspapers. I'm KHOI Civic Reporter Dennis Hart, wishing you, as always, a safe, healthy, and happy weekend.
And those were the voices of students at Elyria, Ohio High School singing "Will the Circle Be Unbroken" during their walkout to the protest gun violence on Wednesday. On next Wednesday, we'll be reporting about what is being planned locally for the National Day of Action being called March for Our Lives, which is scheduled for March 24th, when kids and families will take to the streets of Washington, D.C. and local communities around the country, including Iowa, to demand an end to gun violence and mass shootings at schools. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg. We may see some snow tomorrow, but change is coming. Spring is inching its way along. Temperatures should be in the 40s and 50s for the next week. And the next Saturday after tomorrow, we'll have rain, not snow. So bit by bit, we're heading into spring. And one of the things that at least I love about spring is the return of the birds. Let's take a moment to appreciate one species that is coming back in the middle of March and really is a true harbinger of spring. No, I'm not talking about robins. I'm talking about turkey vultures. Pat Schlarbaum explains.
If you've gone looking for raptors on a clear day, your heart has probably leaped and skipped a beat at the sight of a large soaring bird in the distance, perhaps an eagle or an osprey. But if it's soaring with its wings angled in a V-shape or dihedral and making wobbly circles, it's likely a turkey vulture. An eagle's wing plane is much flatter or straight, whereas the turkey vulture is V-shaped. Vultures ride thermals in the sky and use their keen sense of smell to find fresh carcasses. They are a consummate scavenger, cleaning up the countryside one bite of their hooked beak at a time and never mussing a feather on their bald heads. With a body length of 2.5 feet and a 6-foot wingspan, it is surprising that their body weight is only 2 to 4 pounds. Turkey vultures are birds of prey, like other hawks and eagles. Yet their feet are weak and useless for grabbing prey. Their beaks, however, are powerful enough to rip through the hide of a dead deer or cow. They could smell carrion that's less than 12 to 24 hours old from more than a mile away. They want mammal meat as fresh as possible, preferably that of a plant-eating mammal, and will not eat extremely rotted carcasses. They are not a threat to livestock or pets. When searching for a meal, they often fly low over an area, using their sight and acute sense of smell to find the food. Very few birds have a sense of smell. Vultures are social feeders, which means many might join together to feed on a large carcass with other scavenger birds, such as eagles, hawks, and crows, that might join the feast as well. Turkey vultures often are called buzzards and are found throughout much of the United States and Central and South America, although they are not really buzzards. Buzzards are hawks of the genus Buteo that live mainly in the British Isles. In some areas of our country, however, vultures are commonly called buzzards. This term was probably used by early settlers who arrived in this country, saw our vultures, and thought they were buzzards. Turkey vultures' scientific name is Cathartes aurora, which is Latin for cleansing breeze or purifier. Like all other vultures, the turkey vulture has a bald head. This is so that bits of carrion, or dead meat, do not adhere to the skin as they would to feathers. The turkey vulture often flying low to the ground to pick up the scent of ethylmercaptan, a gas produced by the beginnings of decay in dead animals. The olfactory lobe of its brain, responsible for processing smells, is particularly large compared to that of other animals. This heightened ability to detect odors allows it to search for carrion below the forest canopy out of sight of these winged wonders. Turkey vultures play an important role in the health of our ecosystems. As nature's cleanup crews, they help eliminate rotting carcasses, which helps control the spread of certain diseases and generally helps the air smell a lot better. Due to their stomach acids, they can feed on animals that have died from such things as botulism, anthrax, salmonella, and cholera without causing the vulture to become ill. In fact, their stomach acids actually kill the bacteria and toxins. If a group of vultures consume an infected carcass, the harmful bacteria or toxin is destroyed so that it can no longer spread to other animals or humans. They have been documented killing very weak or very sick animals, but this is very rare. They are not a threat to livestock or pets. Though the vultures prefer to feed on medium to large animals such as deer or sheep, they can be found in roads feeding on roadkill animals as small as squirrels and possums. Like so many other wildlife species, turkey vultures were negatively affected by the use of the pesticide DDT in the late 1950s and 60s. Use of the chemical was banned in 1972 in North America. Today, the population is stable and even increasing for turkey vultures. 40 years ago, it was rare to discover nesting turkey vultures in hollow logs or in the second story of an abandoned farmhouse lacking windows. Today, they are common and widespread in the Americas, and evidence suggests that they are expanding their range northward. This could be because of climate change or because they are able to survive in human-altered landscapes, which may now provide them with more food sources than were present historically. A steady supply of dead pigs at a confinement animal feeding operation, or CAFO, has been added to our landscape. Vultures are one of the most misunderstood and least appreciated birds in the avian world. Many of the opinions formed by people are based on the way vultures are portrayed in movies and cartoons. Many believe that when vultures are circling overhead, they are waiting for an animal to die. Vultures certainly circle and can soar for up to 6 hours without flapping, but they are simply using the thermals to move from place to place and testing air quality for decaying carrion. If on their nest, the vultures will hiss and regurgitate, accurately hitting their target up to 6 feet away. The smell of their vomit is so bad that this defensive move is generally very successful in driving any predators away. Another belief that some people have is that they are dirty, disgusting birds, when in fact, if there is water source available, most vultures will enjoy a bath after a meal. Not only do vultures not pick up many food scraps on their bald head, what they do pick up will easily wash off. Adult vultures have red heads, while young of the year remain dark until their second year. Turkey vultures love to sun themselves with wings draped openly on a perch. This is called a heraldic pose. It is believed that the vulture does this for a variety of reasons. A vulture's body temperature drops overnight, and this pose will help the birds to warm up. This pose is also used after bathing to dry their feathers or dry the morning dew. It may also help to bake off bacteria the vulture has picked up while feeding on carrion. Turkey vultures roost in large groups on dead, leafless trees. Groups of perched vultures are called a wake. Individuals live in the same communal roost most of their life and usually sleep in the same roost in the same tree on their particular branch every night. Groups of vultures are called kettles when they soar upward in spirals. Kettles appear as boiling cauldrons of vultures. Hawks are known to look for kettles to find rising air for their own flight. Each spring and autumn, turkey vultures gather at traditional roosting sites each evening. The Ledges State Park, west of Ames, on the Des Moines River, is one of those destinations.
So as early as mid-March, the turkey vultures can return and start cleaning up the roadways from all the roadkill.
And that's our phenology for today. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames.
And if you've just joined us, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Thank you, Pat Schlarbaum, for that report on the turkey vultures, true harbingers of spring. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for the hour. And for the past few weeks, we've been traveling to the continent of Africa through the eyes of our neighbors that live here in central Iowa, people from African countries who can share firsthand what their homelands are like. Today, Omar El Shire takes us to Egypt. Omar is a student at Iowa State, and he came to KHOI last week. And we had a great conversation about his experiences as an Egyptian. So take a listen. Where are you from in Egypt?
I'm from Cairo.
From Cairo.
I'm the capital.
So you're a city person.
Yeah.
Okay, tell us a little bit about Cairo.
So Cairo's a huge city. It's massive, and it's very, very diverse.
How many people?
20 million. Yeah, so you can imagine coming
from... It's bigger than New York City.
Yeah.
New York City is 14 million.
But yeah, imagine coming from Cairo, from a huge city in the Middle East to Ames, Iowa.
Ames, Iowa. So what's that like? What did you think when you first came here?
Yeah, I was just surprised at how nice people were when I came here. So I came here Christmas Eve of 2016. I landed in Des Moines Christmas Eve because it's Christmas Eve. No one's working. Everyone's, you know, celebrating Christmas. So the airport shuttle that runs between the Des Moines airport and Ames wasn't working. But there was someone, there's a gentleman at the booth in the airport, and he told me that they weren't operating. And he told me to wait for 10 minutes, and he'll get back to me to see if there's something he can do. And then he was going to Ames, personally, not for work, not for anything. He was just going to Ames. So he offered me a ride.
That's nice.
And he didn't accept any money from me. He didn't want to take any money from me. He just kept giving me advice about how to survive in the cold, because I've told him I've never seen snow before. They kept telling me, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. So that was the first experience with any American ever. That was a wonderful experience.
Christmas spirit. Oh, that's really nice. You're a student at Iowa State?
Yeah, I'm a student at Iowa State.
What are you studying?
I'm studying electrical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a senior now.
And why did you come here?
I've lived in Egypt all my life, so and I've always wanted to travel, be it in Iowa or in New York. I didn't mind. I just wanted to go out there, expose myself to a new culture, experience a different lifestyle, live away from home, live away from my parents, live alone, get to know myself a lot more.
Why not study in Egypt?
Well, it's simple. Education system here is better. Get any graduate degree in the U.S. is definitely more appealing, or will give you better job opportunities.
Okay, so tell us about Cairo. Tell us about the Arab Spring. You are of the age that you were smack in the middle of that.
Yeah.
Tell us your story.
So I was born on the 25th of January, 1997. So that makes me 21 now. 25th of January has always been a national holiday. It was always a national holiday, and that made me happy. But it was police day. So in 2011, as a form of protesting against police brutality, just as the powerful hand of a fascist dictatorship, people did not like that and called for protests after the revolution in Tunisia succeeded in January of 2011. So people called for nationwide demonstrations on the 25th of January of 2011. So that was my birthday. Funny thing, I had an English paper due on the 26th of January of 2011. It was a paper on To Kill a Mockingbird for my English class. So on my birthday, I remember sitting at home watching TV, watching the demonstrations and how it was very chaotic how people have broken the barrier of fear, that they don't fear the police anymore. Because before that, no one would ever dream of having a revolution in Egypt. Because you get arrested, then you would be held in solitary confinement, and people would have no idea you're arrested. Your family will be looking for you. They will go to ask the police if they know anything about you, and the police will not say, no, we don't know anything about it. And people will be tortured, inhumanely tortured. Just the description some people say just makes my body shiver. So people couldn't take that anymore. And so they saw what we can exercise autonomy over our own fate. We can be in control of our own fate. And then Egyptians looked at Tunisia and were like, yeah, we can do that too. We can take matters at our own hand. We can actually live in a country that's ours and not the government.
Do you remember discussing that with people?
Yeah, definitely. The revolution started on Facebook. Social media played a huge role in the Egyptian revolution. It was an event on Facebook, actually. People create an event on Facebook. On this day, we will go out into the streets and we will demonstrate. We will demand our rights. So people would say something like, you know, we should allow for people from Tunisia to come here and teach us how to exercise freedom, how to take matters at our own hand. Just mocking Egyptians for not being as brave, as courageous as Tunisians are. But then the Egyptian Revolution broke out. It just started with a few protests on the 25th of January.
So say again what the four demands were.
Bread, freedom, social justice, and human dignity.
Well, who actually were the people that stood up to the police?
Well, it started with activists who were on a suicide mission because they don't know what will happen to them if they get arrested, if the police succeeds in arresting them. They might die of torture.
Were these young people, old people?
It was mainly young people. People between the ages of 20 and 30. And then on television, people saw how peaceful demonstrations were met by rubber bullets and tear gas. So people did not like that. People did not like that they are forced to remain silent, that they cannot speak up, that they can't communicate what they're feeling to the government. So they took out to the streets on the 25th of January. A lot of people got arrested. I think one person died on the 25th. The 26th and the 27th, not so much happened. But then on the 28th, it was rage. It was a Friday. So Friday is a day off. The weekends back home are Friday and Saturday. So on Friday, people usually go to the mosque. So people called for demonstrations after Friday prayer. So they would have momentum already because people are already in the mosque. So if you leave the mosque and go to a demonstration, you'll have a huge demonstration packed with people. So people refer to that as the Friday of Wrath because they couldn't take it anymore. Police cars were hitting people in the streets just because they're protesting. They were not armed with guns or anything. They were peaceful protesters chanting peaceful chants, asking for their basic human rights. The chants called for, they'd say, عيش حرية, عدالة اجتماعية, كرامة إنسانية. So they're asking for four things. They're asking for bread, freedom, social justice, and human dignity. I think the smartest thing to do was for the president to go out and ask for a referendum. Do you want me as president or do you not want me as president? But that never happened. The Muslim Brotherhood held tenaciously to the presidential chair and they did not want to let go of it. And they claimed that they had legitimacy, which they did. So the military took advantage of that. And they led a military coup in 2013, rebranding it as a revolution or putting up the facade that it was a revolution. Yes, people did not want Morsi, but people did not want a military general to be in power. So the military overthrew the president and assumed power. And then the military general at the time resigned from the military and then ran for elections in 2014 and won the election by a mind-blowing 96%.
Which doesn't really exist in elections.
Not really, no.
Nobody's really heard of those numbers.
No. So that was 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Fast forward till 2018, the elections are in a few days. And the five presidential candidates all got arrested. So the president is currently running for president against himself. But to make it seem like an election, to stage it as an election, one of his supporters is running against him, holding no election campaign, just to make it seem as a democracy, although mm-hmm. everyone knows it's not.
So how's the level of frustration in the country?
Very high, uh-huh. very high. But with the level of, since the level of frustration is very high, the police has gotten better since the revolution at silencing people. They've gotten better at torturing people. They've gotten better at terrorizing people.
So does it feel like things are pretty much gone back to where they were before, if not worse?
Definitely worse. But I refuse to believe that it's over. I like to believe that the revolution is still alive and the revolution will not end until it succeeds. So from the 25th of January until this day, and until the day the revolution succeeds, whether this be when I'm living or when I'm not, the revolution will still be running. The revolution is still on because we cannot allow the bad guys to win.
So do you love your country?
Of course I do. But that does not mean that I have to love my government. I hate my government. I despise my government and all its entity. But definitely I love my country. I feel homesick.
Why do you love your country?
Because that's home to me. That's family. That's friends. That's when I walk on the streets and feel like I'm home. That is home. It's very hard to express it and explain to someone why it's home.
Can you describe it a little bit to us?
I can try.
Yeah, just give us, paint us a picture of what it's like.
It's just walking on the streets, having people around me who look like me, who speak like me, who can connect with me. People who are struggling through the same things I'm struggling through. People who have dreams like I do. I mean, this is kind of a vague description because I'm describing all human beings, but mm-hmm. I'm mainly talking about human beings who, yes, live in Cairo, who support the Egyptian national team, who you know, when Mohamed Salah, one of the best football players in Egypt, scores a goal, the whole nation erupts in cheering, feeling happy just because this man is Egyptian and he's making us feel proud that we're Egyptians. I don't think that any words will suffice to explain why home is home. But mm-hmm. simply put, home is home.
What I hear in you, you do feel a pride over your country.
Definitely.
Even though you, mm-hmm. you don't like the government, you feel pride mm-hmm. about what Egypt is.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. I have a lot to say against Egypt, a lot. There are a lot of aspects that I think need to be changed. But I can't run away from my identity because of some negative aspects. I definitely want to go back and be part of a force that will implement change.
Do you think there is a possibility that somehow this process can still?
Definitely. Ever since I am a byproduct of the revolution. The way I think is very revolutionary in its essence. Mm-hmm. I was 14 when the revolution erupted. The generation older than me, my parents' generation, have always been terrorized. They've always been forced to fear the government, forced to aim for stability rather than human dignity. So you'd have a lot of old people who are in support of these dictatorships just because they want stability. They want to make sure that they will have food on the table, that the country won't break loose and, you know, a civil war will break out.
But you don't think that way because
I don't think that way. And I think that we should always take the risk so long as it's for the better, so long as it's for the good, so long as we're trying to make it better for everyone and not just make it better for a small sect of people. But whether I want to go back right after graduation or wait for a while.
Give us a description that helps us feel the beauty of Egypt and the people there. Give us an event or a place or food or anything that we can relate to kind of as humans to help us feel the beauty of the culture.
Egypt is an Arab country, and hospitality is a huge part of Arabian culture. To not be hospitable is to be rude to your guests. So people take that to an extreme. They take that to a whole new level. So you will walk into a house. There will be a feast, and you get to choose whatever it is you want to choose from the food. Your host will force you to eat more because, you know, we prepared all this food for you. So come on, you know, show us that you appreciate us hosting you and providing all this for you. Do you want coffee? Do you want tea? What can I offer for you? Because it's part of Arabian culture, ancient Arabian culture, 1500, 1600 years ago.
So what do you have to say to Americans?
One, I'd say be mindful of other cultures. Know that there are other cultures out there in the world. Try not to be self-absorbed or think that the world ends in a farm and, you know, country. There's life beyond what you know. There was life beyond what I knew. And coming here was definitely an eye-opener for me. So I would encourage everyone, not just Americans, but everyone, even people back home who refuse to leave their comfort zone, expose yourself to new cultures, expose yourself to new people, see how other people think. And that will definitely be an eye-opener for everyone and will make you appreciate I like to believe in a global human culture, that no matter where you go, there will be some kind of connection that you feel with other people, even if you don't speak the same language. So yeah, but definitely a lot of Americans don't know how privileged they are to have the rights that they do have.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That's an anthem for Egyptian Revolution that we're hearing in the background. I wish I could understand the words. And if you've just joined us, I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Margaret Curry is with us from the Iowa State University Biography Dictionary Project. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank
Maggie?
You. Yeah, Maggie.
Maggie?
Unless I'm in trouble, yeah.
Okay. Maggie, you are definitely not in trouble. Thank you for coming and telling us about the Biography Dictionary Project.
Well, thank you for having me, yes.
So this is with the University Museums.
Yes.
And so explain to us what exactly this project is. What is the Biography Dictionary?
So the Iowa State University Biographical Dictionary is really intended to be a reference work. And I'm on working for them kind of as a project manager through the university museums, but there's also special collections on campus is part of it, and several Iowa historical societies, really. So this is a group of people who got together and said, hey, Iowa State University has a really rich history and a really big impact both on the state and national and even around the world, and they wanted to kind of memorialize that. And so they're putting together this reference work, and its publication date is set for 2019, so it'll be both a book and then available online. And it's really meant to be that place to go where you can get that information about the people who made Iowa State special and then who came to Iowa State and left and made other places special.
So is this about everybody who went to Iowa State, or is this about the famous people who went to Iowa State, or what's the criteria?
Kind of,
who makes it into the book?
Yes. So there's about 500 names included, and I know I wasn't there for the choice process, but I know it was very difficult. And we still get people who are like, oh, but I know somebody who is so amazing. And that's what's so great about Iowa State is there are so many people who are so amazing.
I'm sure there are.
In 160 years of history, it's really hard to narrow it down. So the criteria they really set for this first edition was someone past or present, they can still be living, who has gained state, national, world prominence, or who had a lasting impact on Iowa State's culture. And you could really see that throughout history and how the university expanded in ways like that.
And this, it goes all the way from the beginning of Iowa State until now.
Right. So right from its formation, it's going to include people that you would expect, you know, all the presidents are going to be in there. A lot of the department heads are going to be in there. It's got the founders and some of the people who were there really shaping what was the school going to be and what was it going to do. It's going to include Morrill from the Morrill Act, because without him, we wouldn't have land-grant universities. So there are those people who are really important right at the beginning, but also people who came in, you know, later on and when the university was facing struggles and times were changing and what could they do to make it better.
And is there an attempt to cover, like, all different disciplines or?
They were very conscious about making sure that everyone was represented. And I've had – I mean, it's so easy to – it started as an agricultural college, right? So a lot of those beginning people went on to invent amazing agricultural things. And I've gained a lot of knowledge just from reading all these different entries as they're coming in and editing through them about all these inventors. But the university's expanded so much that they're very conscious of including the different disciplines and what have people done in education, what did they do when it was like home sciences and different programs like that.
Now, this is called a biographical.
Yes.
It's kind of two loaded words, biographical and dictionary.
I feel like you kind of have to unpack it because you hear it and you're like, what?
Yeah.
It sounds to me, when I think through it, more like an encyclopedia. And I think as I'm reading it, it's like an encyclopedia of people.
Okay.
But it functions like a dictionary, if that makes sense, in the sense that if you were like, who is this person? I'm going to go look them up and see their history. That's where the dictionary part comes in.
And there'll be an alphabetical order.
Alphabetical order. Just to make it easier.
Not historical consecutive.
Not historical consecutive order, and not by department or area of expertise, because there are people who maybe they began in one area but mm-hmm. influenced so many that you couldn't possibly kind of stick them in a corner. That wouldn't be fair to them.
And do we think of the classical encyclopedia entry where you have maybe four paragraphs about their life?
It is restricted to about 1,000 words. So for some people, that's very hard. For some people, it's very easy because maybe they had so many different things or such a long life that you could talk forever. You could write a book on some of these people, and I would highly encourage someone to. A lot of these people are really interesting.
Are you experiencing that as you're working on this?
Completely. I think it's really opened my eyes. As a student at Iowa State, I'm connected to my experience and the people who are there with me right now.
Mm-hmm.
But my parents also went to Iowa State, and now I'm learning about things that they knew and my great-grandparents might have experienced and things like that. And it's also kind of opened my eyes to how different my experience is now and helps me connect more on that alumni level of this institution that I know and I love, and I get to know so much more about it and the people who walked here before me.
That's kind of nice. So gives you that continuity of the world you're walking into when you graduate, right?
Right.
Uh-huh.
And it's very interesting. One of the guys I've been working on that I've been writing was, I believe his name's James Geddes, and he was the original military instructor. And that was really important in the Morrill Act when they were creating land-grant institutions. It was right after the Civil War, and they had an issue on the north side of getting people like into troops. They just kind of weren't trained or organized properly. And they were like, oh, we should use these land grant institutions to make sure we have military training as part of our education.
On the north side, meaning during
the Union,
during the Civil War.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that was a big part of Iowa State's founding education, was there needed to be military instruction. And there actually was required military instruction through most of the 1900s. And it didn't really stop until like 1970s when students were like, why?
So that was obligatory then. It wasn't just ROTC.
Mm-mm. It was something you, very early days, you got up, you had chapel included in there, you had military instruction, you went out and drilled, you had your classes.
All students?
All students.
Women and men?
I think women were not required. I came across there were like women's drill teams, so they would compete. And I think, especially when the college was so small originally, it's very obvious when you're not included in some of the social activities. So it might have been a way for them to have something to do and be part of it, even if it wasn't required.
So that probably explains why Iowa State has such a distinguished ROTC
I think
department.
So. I think that history. And one of the things that was interesting about Geddes was anyone who was an administrator later on in Iowa State who went to Iowa State as a student or a faculty member or anything like that would have had him as an instructor. And so a lot of people said that when they saw these later on administrators, they could see that military bearing and attitude and preciseness that was taught to them by this man. So his legacy really carried over in unexpected ways. Mm-hmm. And I know all of that now, and I never would have. Why would I know that? You know, but it mm-hmm. helps me appreciate, especially like Lake Laverne was where they used to drill. So now I walk past there and I'm like, that's just, it would have been totally different for them.
You mean the land where
The land where
Lake Laverne
is. They weren't standing
is.
In the lake at the time. But the land where it is.
That used to be a drill ground.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because one of the things they struggled with was they had this intention from both the state to create the military instruction, and the state would fund like the necessary guns and cannons and swords and things that they would use, but they didn't have the funds to store them properly. So then they weren't taken care of, and then they'd need to be replaced. And it was one of those interesting things where you could see like the university already talking to the state about funding over this thing as simple as like a shack to put these things in. Mm-hmm. So it was really interesting to see how these things kind of carry over in the relationship Iowa State has with other entities.
Mm-hmm. And now you also mentioned that this project connects you to larger academic world. What do you mean by that?
Yes. So what's interesting about this project is that there are actually only two other universities who have biographical dictionaries. One is Princeton, and the other is actually Oxford University in England, but theirs stops in like the 1500s. They did not even get close to contemporary. So it really sets Iowa State apart as we're somewhere important. We've done important things, and we've had important people come through here who've made real impacts, and it puts us up there with those kind of universities that maybe have more of a name brand.
And why did Iowa State decide to do this now?
I think a lot of it was we were coming up on some big years. So 160 years, that's a big accomplishment. I know there was a lot of, in the sesquicentennial, there's a lot of that celebration of history and trying to go back and find all of this. And I think that spirit kind of continued, and they said, let's try and really focus on the people and appreciate the people who have come through and left Iowa State.
The ISU museums are taking the lead on this with the help of a lot of other organizations.
With the help of a lot of other organizations.
Yeah. Speaking of help, there are ways that the person listening to this interview could help.
Oh, yes.
Possibly.
So I mentioned there's about 500 names, and we have 400 entries already completed. So we're really far along in the process. We're trying to just wrap up this authoring phase. And we're looking for people who are interested in either learning more about Iowa State, or maybe they'll recognize someone on our list of who's still left to be written about that they want to learn more about, or they want to help us remember. So really, we're looking for authors who are interested. They're very short entries. You get to do some interesting research, and I actually will help you along the entire way. That is my job. So we're really looking for people who are interested in joining our project. It's a volunteer opportunity.
Would you recommend it, having worked on it?
Oh, 110%. Especially because you can author as many as you want. You know, if you see one you find interesting, great. If you think, I just want to learn about a handful of people or a department, this is the perfect thing for you. I really don't know where else you would have this opportunity kind of come across you to learn this much. And you get to really see the people for themselves. You get to read their letters, and you get to read things from their families, and it's very interesting.
Okay, so how does one do that? If somebody's listening to this,
yes.
And you're like, okay, how do I learn more about it?
So you're welcome to email me. My email is mjcurry, like the spice, at iastate.edu. iastate.edu.
And repeat it again.
MJ Curry, like the spice, at iastate.edu. You can also, if that's difficult, and I totally understand, you can contact university museums or the university archives at the library, and they'll help connect you to either their representative or to me.
Okay, thank you. Any last words? We got about a minute left. Anything, any last word?
You know,
thank you for coming in. It's very interesting.
I really don't. It's such a nice spring week. I'm just having a good time.
Okay, and you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Thank you, Maggie Curry, for coming in from the Iowa State University Biographical Dictionary Project. And I've been your host today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in today. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI. Also, remember that you can hear a recording of this show online later today and later in the week and find links to the guests and information, including Maggie's contact information. KHOI streaming live at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Remember that Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from ISU Theater, presenting Oklahoma, a musical love story of Cowboy Curly and Farm Girl Lori, April 5th through the 8th in Ames. Tickets and showtimes available at theater.iastate.edu.